We'll get started because the recording is began sharply at 9 o'clock. Good morning, the Board of Directors of Vicor Corporation. Welcome you to the 2017 Annual Shareholders Meeting. I'm Jamie Sims, CFO, Secretary, and Treasurer. I'm also Director of the company. As provided for under Article 1, Section 8 of the Corporation's bylaws, I'll serve as Chairman of this meeting as well as Secretary. Each of you should have registered in the lobby as you entered the building, and if there are any of you who have not registered for the meeting, would you please at this time step over to the back there, and our assistant will help you sign the stockholder register. Be sure to pick up an agenda, which is on the, and on the reverse side of it has our rules of conduct for today's meeting. As you may have seen upon entering, we have copies of the annual report available for attendees. It is a bound combination of our proxy statement and our Form 10-K filing. So on the screen is the comprehensive safe harbor statement comparable to the language that we include in other public statements regarding the company's financial or operational performance, such as our filings, press releases, or other quarterly calls. I will not recite the full text, but I do remind you, as I do on our earnings calls, various remarks we make today may constitute forward-looking statements for the purposes of the safe harbor provisions under the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. Statements we may make, including explicit or implicit references to technologies, products, customers, opportunities, sales trends, spending, and profitability, are forward-looking statements involving risks and uncertainties. In light of these risks and uncertainties, which are discussed in our most recent Form 10-K, filed on March 7, 2017, available in the back of the room, we can offer no assurance that any forward-looking statement will in fact prove to be correct. Consistent with NASDAQ Rule 5620, shareholders are afforded the opportunity to discuss company affairs with management at this meeting. However, as shown at the bottom of the screen, Vicor is in its quiet period for the second quarter of 2017, and as such, we will not comment on specific elements of financial or operational performance for the second quarter or for any forward period. Second quarter performance will be addressed during our upcoming earnings call, which we anticipate will be on Thursday, July 27th. On the screen is the agenda for today's event. As shown, we'll conduct a formal business meeting, keeping it as brief as possible, reviewing the seven proposals that were before stockholders, as well as any business to be brought before the meeting today. As of now, I'm unaware of any such additional business. After we take care of formal business, Patricio will take your questions regarding the company's strategy and products. Again, he cannot answer questions regarding our financial or operational performance for the second quarter or for the full year. I also caution you, Patricio will not be responding to questions regarding patent litigation. Information about the status of legal matters can be found in the company's filings with the SEC, certain of our press releases, and in public filings made by certain federal circuit courts and the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, all of which may be found on the Internet. As has been in the case in the past, we'll be posting an audio recording of today's business meeting and subsequent Q&A on the Investor Relations page of our website. I'll now introduce my nine fellow members of the Corporation's Board of Directors. Patricio Vinciarelli, Chairman of the Board, President and CEO, who founded the company in 1981. Claudio Tuzzolo, President of our Picor subsidiary. Claudio has been a director since 2007 and with the company since 2001. And yours truly. In alphabetical order, our non-employee directors who are not considered independent for purposes of NASDAQ rules are Sam Anderson, CEO of Isomos Technology, Alan Henderson, who was appointed to the board in 2014 upon his retirement from Vicor after three decades of service leading the company's Westcor division in California, Barry Kelleher, who retired at the end of last year as president of our brick business unit. Barry had been an employee director from 1999 and joined Vicor in 1993. In alphabetical order, our independent directors are Jason Carlson. Jason, unfortunately, is stuck in Europe, was not able to make it this morning. He is the CEO of Cognitech AG, headquartered in Dugendorf, Germany. Estia Eichen is an original investor in the company, having known Patricio since the 70s. Liam Griffin is the CEO and director of Skyworks Solutions and has had that role since May of 2015. He joined the predecessor company, Alpha Industries, in August 2001, and he's been on our board since 2009. My last introduction, and indeed my last introduction, of David Ridderford. Unfortunately, David couldn't be with us today. He is ill. David announced his retirement not long ago and is stepping down after 33 years of service to the company. Recognize Gabor Garai and thank him for the facilities. He's our outside counsel. Introduce Rick Sharon and Ed Sullivan. Rick is our independent auditor from KPMG. And then Dan Glennon, where are you, Dan? Representing ComputerShare Trust Company, the corporation's transfer agent. Dan has been appointed to act as Inspector of Election, also known as the teller, for the formal business portion of the meeting. Thanks to everyone for attending. So now I'll call the meeting to order. On the screen is the agenda for the official business portion of today's meeting. Notice of the meeting was sent to all stockholders of record as of April 28, 2017, officially designated the record date. All stockholders of record on that date are entitled to vote at this meeting either by proxy or in-person ballot. Similarly, only stockholders of record are entitled to present proposals during the business portion of this meeting. The affidavit of mailing and the notice of meeting have been delivered by the teller to me and will be filed with the minutes and records of today's meeting. The proxy statement was filed with the SEC on May 1st and mailed to stockholders shortly thereafter and sets forth seven proposals from management for stockholder vote here today. The board recommends stockholders vote in favor of all seven proposals. While under Rule 14A8 under the Exchange Act, we must include in our proxy statement appropriately submitted proposals from eligible shareholders. I, in my capacity of secretary, confirm that we have not received any such proposal, and none are included in our proxy statement. This slide sets forth the number of shares of common stock and shares of Class B stock as of the prior 2 year ends and as of the record date. These figures are presented on a basic basis, reflecting only shares outstanding eligible to vote. Said another way, the dilutive impact of any options exercisable within 60 days of these dates has been excluded. So do not try and reconcile them back to the numbers that are in the annual report. As shown as of the record date, our outstanding shares consisted of 27,372,402 shares of common and 11,758,218 shares of Class B. I remind you, our outstanding Class B shares possess 10 votes per share, although they are exchangeable only on a one-for-one basis for shares of common stock. As shown, holders of our Class B shares, of which there are 13, possess, as of the record date, 81.1% of the cumulative voting power of the 144.9 million votes eligible as of the record date. Also as of the record date, Dr. Vinciarelli owned 35.3% of the common stock shares outstanding and 93.7% of B shares outstanding, representing 82.5% of total voting power, giving him control over all governance matters. On a fully converted basis, Dr. Vinciarelli's holdings represented 54.3% of share ownership. Because of this control under the corporate governance requirements of NASDAQ Rule 5600, we are considered a controlled company, which is defined as a listed entity for which more than 50% of the voting power for the election of directors is held by an individual or an identified group. As such, we rely on the exemptions set forth in Rule 5615, paragraph C2, from paragraph B of 5605, which requires a majority of directors be independent, and paragraph E, which requires the nominating process be the sole responsibility of independent directors. We do not utilize the available exemption from independent director oversight of executive compensation, but instead maintain a compensation committee comprised solely of independent directors. Of course, there is no exemption from maintaining an audit committee comprised solely of independent directors, which we do. Directors Carlson, Eichten, and Griffin are considered independent and will be the sole members of our board's compensation and audit committees for the 2017 term. Returning to procedure, our first order of business shall be to determine whether the shares represented at the meeting, either in person or by proxy, are sufficient to constitute a quorum for the purpose of transacting business. I introduced Dan earlier. Dan has been appointed to serve as the inspector, having pledged faithfully to perform his duties under the General Corporation Laws of Delaware and to support me in the conduct of this meeting. His pledge will be filed with the minutes and records of this meeting. Are there any shareholders in attendance today who have not submitted a proxy but who wish to vote in person? If so, please raise your hand so that Dan may confirm your eligibility as of the record date and give a ballot to you. Stockholders present should be aware, for purposes of preparing the slides used today, we have assumed those that have signed and submitted a proxy, even though present, intend to vote by that proxy. However, are there any stockholders who previously submitted a proxy who would like to change their vote on any matters before stockholders? If so, identify yourself for Dan. Seeing none, I now ask Dan, in his capacity as teller, to inform us whether a quorum is present.
Mr. Chairman, I can report, as of the record date, April 28, 2017, 27,372,402 shares of common stock and 11,758,218 shares of Class B stock were outstanding, representing an eligible total of 124,954,582 possible votes, as shown on your slide. Given our receipt of Dr. Vincelli's proxy, representing 82.5% of eligible votes, far more than the simple majority of eligible votes required for a quorum, are represented here today. As you have just seen, I have received no new ballots nor any instructions to withdraw or change an existing proxy. So the numbers previously reported and shown on your slide are accurate. As for the record date, Vicor had 161 holders of common stock, defined as held of record under Rule 12G5-1 of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. Representing the sum of stockholders identified by Computershare as distinct holders in possession of their shares, or stockholders whose shares are held by a custodian or a single account. A complete list of stockholders as of the record date, compiled and certified by Computershare, is open for examination at this meeting by any stockholder.
Thank you, Dan. I therefore declare a quorum. The polls are now open and will remain open until the matters before the meeting have been presented and the teller confirms no votes have been cast other than those received by our proxy. We will now proceed with the discussion and voting of the seven proposals set forth in the proxy statement. Since the proposals were addressed in detail in the proxy statement, and since 94.3% of shares eligible to vote are represented by proxy at this meeting, we will dispense with the formal motions and balloting for the seven proposals. Further, as Dan mentioned, Dr. Vinciarelli's proxy, representing 82.5% of eligible votes, has been received and voted in favor of each of the seven proposals. Therefore, each proposal received prior to today's meeting had more than enough votes for approval. In order to provide stockholders the opportunity to discuss the proposals, I will briefly describe them and ask for comments and questions. As shown on the slide before you, the first proposal is to fix the number of directors at 9, reflecting Mr. Ritterford's retirement, and to re-elect the 9 incumbent directors. The board, which acts as a whole when considering the composition and size of the board, concluded upon Mr. Ritterford's notification of his intent to retire at the end of the current term, which is today, that the 3 independent directors could appropriately meet the requirements of NASDAQ Rule 50605B and D for audit and compensation committees, respectively, to be made up solely of independent directors, 3 in the case of the Audit Committee and 2 in the case of the Compensation Committee. As such, the board has voted to recommend to stockholders the number of directors for the term be returned to 9 and the 9 incumbent directors be reelected. Each stockholder was entitled to vote for a maximum of 9 nominees. Cumulative voting was not permitted. Is there any discussion regarding the size of the board or the election of directors? The second and third proposals before stockholders are associated with the SEC's rules implementing say-on-pay provisions of Section 951 of the Dodd-Frank Act, which requires public companies to allow for stockholder votes on the compensation of named executive officers. The second proposal represents our third vote on stockholder approval of our NEO's compensation, as disclosed in the compensation discussion analysis section of the proxy statement, consistent with the disclosure standards of the SEC. The third proposal is our second vote on the frequency of say-on-pay votes, the first of which occurred in 2011. These votes are required to occur every 6 years. As set forth in the proxy statement, the board has voted to recommend stockholder approval of the compensation paid to our NEOs, as well as approval of maintaining the vote frequency at every 3 years. Because this vote is advisory, its outcome will not be binding upon the compensation committee. However, the committee does consider these votes when making future decisions regarding executive compensation. Is there any discussion of the two say-on-pay proposals? The fourth proposal before stockholders has to do with approving the amendment to the Vicor Corporation Amended and Restated 2000 Stock Option and Incentive Plan to increase the number of shares available for issuance under the plan to 10 million from the current level of 4 million. As discussed in the proxy statement, the board approved this increase on April 26th, subject to shareholder approval today. The rationale for the increase is to address possible future needs for higher volumes of awards under the plan, most likely in accommodation of potential internal restructuring transactions. The board has voted to recommend stockholder approval of the proposed increase in the number of shares of common stock allocated for issuance under the Vicor plan. Is there any discussion of the proposed increase? Proposals 5 and 6 are related and similar in that they ask for stockholder approval to amendments of the stock option plans of our two subsidiaries, VI Chip Corporation and Vicor Corporation. As shown on the screen and set forth in the proxy statement, the proposals involve the amended and restated VI Chip Corporation 2007 Stock Option and Incentive Plan and the amended and restated Vicor Corporation 2001 Stock Option and Incentive Plan. Stockholder approval of these amendments of these two separate subsidiary plans is approved by their respective boards and the board of directors of Vicor Corporation will allow the corporation to address a substantial number of expiring subsidiary options, notably VI chip options, while also providing flexibility and time for us to assess the appropriate outcome for these subsidiary option plans and the subsidiaries themselves. Under Proposal 5, the number of VI chip subsidiary shares available for issuance under the plan will be increased from 12 to 14 million shares. No increases considered for the PICOR plan. Proposals 5 and 6, the amendments to those, harmonize both subsidiary plans, particularly the terms associated with provisions of 162M of the Internal Revenue Code, which require stockholder approval of a plan at least once every 5 years in order to protect the qualification of awards under the plan as performance-based compensation. Shareholder approval will constitute approval of the material terms of the respective plans for purposes of Section 162M. Is there any discussion of the two proposals? Our seventh and final proposal before stockholders asks for approval of a new Employee Stock Purchase Plan, or ESPP. If approved, the ESPP will be effective today, June 16th, but the first of 6 distinct subsequent offering periods of 6 months each under the plan will not begin until September 1st, after a period of employee education, documentation, and enrollment. Participating employees may elect to deduct up to 15% of their eligible compensation to be used for purchasing newly issued shares at the end of each 6-month offering period. purchase price will be based on what is commonly referred to as a look-back calculation, which bases the per-share price on the lower of 85% of market value at the beginning of the six-month period or 85% of the market value at the end of the six-month period. Participants will be limited by formula to purchasing no more than $25,000 worth of shares in a given calendar year. Participation will be voluntary, and shares purchased will be funded through payroll deductions on an after-tax basis. The ESPP will be managed by E-Trade, which manages our current Vicor stock option program. Prior to voting to approve the ESPP on April 26th, the board assessed, among other considerations, the overall effectiveness of the corporation's compensation and benefits practices, the historical levels of employee participation in existing stock option plans, the historical price performance of shares of the company's common stock relative to such plans and participation levels, potential participation in the ESPP reflecting regulatory eligibility, the regulatory limits on employee contributions, and finally, similar plans offered by public companies and the dilutive impact of adopting the plan. The board also assessed the implications for compliance with federal tax regulation if participation in a plan were made available to resident employees of the corporation's subsidiaries that are domiciled in and operating in foreign jurisdictions. The board is seeking approval of the ESPP to satisfy requirements of sections 421 and 423 of the Internal Revenue Code, as we intend for the plan to qualify as an employee stock purchase plan under Section 423. Is there any further discussion of the proposed plan? Not hearing any regarding the seven proposals set forth in the proxy statement, I ask now whether there are any other matters to be properly brought before the annual meeting by an eligible shareholder. Hearing none, I'll ask again whether there is a stockholder who has not cast a ballot and now wishes to do so. There appearing to be none, I now formally close the poll.
I'm sorry, I raised my hand.
Sorry?
Yes, I actually like to cast a ballot.
Oh, well, please talk to...
I apologize.
That's all right. All right, talk to Mr. Glennon. Assuming that is the last of any final balloting, I'll formally close the polls. And based on the totals previously provided by Computershare and seeing the results as presented earlier, I am pleased to report the following results. Depending upon the number of shares involved here, the totals you see will not materially change. We will be reporting the final results as required under a filing of an 8K within 4 days, and it will have all of the detail of the final numbers shown. All nine directors standing for re-election received an affirmative vote of at least 97.3% and 91.8% of shares entitled to vote. Therefore, all nine directors are re-elected. And then, as you can see, all of the proposals before stockholders were approved with a minimum of 95.8% approval. There being no further business to come before the meeting, I will entertain a motion to adjourn. Thank you. All in favor of adjournment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Vote is in favor of an adjournment. This concludes the formal portion of the meeting. At this time, Patricia will take your questions. Once again, I remind everyone we are in our Q2 quiet period, and accordingly, Patricia will not be commenting on current operational or financial performance, John. Nor will he respond to forward-looking questions regarding patent litigation. As always, I repeat the invitation for interested parties to participate in our quarterly conference calls. And with that, I give you Patricia.
Thank you.
I'll kick it off.
Sure.
Teresa, you just talked about how you have enabling technology and how you can make computers faster. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that. Your technology is so small, you can get close to the processor. How does that actually speed up the computer? And the follow-on question to that is, do the customers really understand this, that you do have this technology that can make the computers faster?
I'll start with the second half first. I think the large universe of customers are as yet unaware of this kind of capability.
Unaware.
If you are, and those are the ones we've engaged with at the very beginning of our so-called Power and Package initiative. I think it was a board in that room that highlights a more conventional deployment of some of our chips on a motherboard, and in that particular example, you can see a variety of devices that are sprinkled throughout the board. That's a striking difference relative to a power on package approach. If it were a power on package and you were to look at the corresponding board, you would say, what happened to the Vigor chips? They're gone. Because they'd be under the hood of, or the lid of the ASIC GPU or processor that they're powering. And they would typically be flanking the ASIC from two sides, or they could be behind on the bottom side of the ASIC substrate. What that affords is proximity to devices which, with the passage of time, as of recent, gather to demand levels of current that I think as recently as a few years ago, I would never imagine that being demanded. Some of these needs are coming up in the context of artificial intelligence. Other ones are coming up in the context of very high-performance devices, whether it's Intel or a number of aspiring competitors. It's become clear in the last year in particular that to achieve a unprecedented level of computing capability, a very high level of current capability is needed. And at those levels, delivering it from the outside of the package becomes very, very challenging. I think many of us have a sense of what, let's say, 10 amps of current represents. It takes, to distribute 10 amps over, a length of wire. It would probably take a wire not much smaller than that. A wire of that size would probably be good enough for 20, 30 amps. Some of these latest and greatest devices can suck up as much as 800, 900 amperes. Okay, so that's about 30 times the current draw that most of us are familiar with in a variety of settings. And delivering that level of current from outside the package is becoming very, very challenging. For one thing, the distribution losses, getting the current to the ASIC by way of the ASIC pins, become prohibitive, meaning given that the ASIC typically operates with voltages nowadays in the 0.8 volt level, you could easily lose a good fraction of that 0.8 volt just interconnecting through the pins of the ASIC. And that's in spite of the need to allocate a large number of pins to this function. And by the way, you need to deliver the current and you get to take it back. So there's a factor of two in the current delivery associated with delivering the current and then returning it to the source. Also, as you can imagine, the allocation of ASIC pins for power delivery and retrieval is in conflict with, obviously, the primary function of the ASIC package, which should be to interconnect the signals coming in and out of the ASIC. So, implicitly, what I just described is an opportunity to, first of all, achieve much higher efficiency by eliminating major power distribution losses, interconnecting to and by way of interconnect pins to the ASIC. There is an opportunity to reclaim, you know, precious pins for signal high-speed communication. So this is a highly leveraged capability, and going back to your two-part question, it is one that at this point is not yet generally appreciated, but one which we've engaged with thus far with primarily three customers. And in that regard, with one, we have just completed the first installation. So that involved, I think, around 36,000 or so-called MCMs. These are modular current multipliers that have been co-packaged with an ASIC, flanking the ASIC from two sides. We've been working with another customer, which is, in effect, a company we've been working with for many years, on developing this general capability, but that's not gone into production yet. And we've had, within the last 3 or 4 months, an exciting level of discussions for applying this MCM-MCD technology, the modular current multiplier, which again can be co-packaged with ASICs or packaged very close to ASICs on the size of the ASIC, with yet another customer in the GPU space. So power package, I think, is a way of the future for chips that require very high current capability. The partitioning of factorized power building blocks that is required for power package is similar to, but notably somewhat different from traditional PRM and BTM. The partition is done a different way. We have significant IP with respect to this whole field. And we're looking to deploy it with a growing customer base. I think to apply the product this way will take time because it obviously requires an orchestrated plan with some level of coordination among various facets of the challenge. Even though in the case of the first customer that went into production with it, we were able to make it happen in about 6 months. But the typical gestation period with, in effect, more conservative customers would be probably the order of a year and a half.
Let me see if I understand this. So because your technology is so small and you have to put it in the package, the first thing you do is pre-up pins for the ASIC or the processor.
Yeah.
And that gives them more capability than they would have because I've worked with engineers my whole life. They're always complaining about running out of pins. So that's, I understand that part. But then also you can put like the memory closer to the processor so the interconnect's shorter. So you can have faster interconnect time.
I think the primary benefit is within the processor itself. I think, to your point, freeing up a lot of pins, which would otherwise be required for power delivery or current delivery, is a big deal. Being able to keep the voltage as delivered to the ASIC to the right level, by eliminating series resistance or series impedance associated with conventional delivery through pins, that's a big deal. Being able to eliminate so-called bypass capacitors that ASIC typically require in order to provide the rest of our energy or current capability. That's a big deal as well because obviously those capacities cost money and take up space. So there's a number of benefits to these. It does require the co-packaging extra complexity that would not be there if MCMs were not needed within the package. So for devices that do not require several hundred amperes, the extra complexity of co-packaging MCMs with an ASIC might not be worth it. But for devices, and there's a growing multiplicity of those that, you know, push the envelope in terms of current draw, then there's a major advantage. I mean, the efficiency improvements can be 10-15% just by virtue of co-packaging the MCMs within the ASIC. So what's not shown there, and what only a few customers have seen thus far, is an MCM package which is half the thickness of our VTMs. So we were able to, last year, take unique packaging technology to a next level of proficiency to, in effect, thin down the current multiplier, which is only now 2.5 millimeters thick. Our standard VTMs are nearly double that thickness. So that's also a factor in allowing these chips to be co-packaged either under the lid of the ASIC or out on the outside on the substrate or on the back of the substrate where room can be made for devices only 2.5 millimeters thick, whereas room could not be made for a device with the characteristic dimensions of the chips that are shown on that motherboard. By the way, these new packages can also be deployed on the motherboard itself. That's perhaps the way in which most customers are going to get to first see them, and that may over time inspire more of them having deployed them successfully on their motherboard that is not within the ASIC package but on the outside of it, that may give them the comfort necessary to want to move them in.
So for the average investor, I think it's almost impossible for them to understand. I think what you're saying is by moving it like an inch closer, you can save up to 10-15% of the power
Part of it is the inch, because an inch is a long way. If you get to carry, let's say, 500 amps, it's 500 amps is a humongous amount of current, right? Particularly at 0.8 volts. So with our approach, to be clear, we can deliver the same amount of power at in the applications thus far 1/64 of the current level, because the current multiplier that we enable co-packaging with the ASIC multiplies the current and divides the voltage by a factor of 64. So 640 amps turns into 10 amps, which is a much more mundane level of current delivery and retrieval to an ASIC. You know, another aspect of this, and there are really many, is bandwidth. So the bandwidth of the solution can be improved. Some of these applications that draw very large current levels are very dynamic, and the current draw at levels of 700-800 amps is not continuous. It only lasts for microseconds. Our technology is uniquely equipped to support these kinds of needs. The conventional competitive alternative involving traditional multi-phase solutions, you know, works on totally different conversion principles that, in effect, impede sudden current delivery, because the whole mechanism for regulation is predicated on serial storage of energy through any impedance, an inductor. So here's another differentiating point, which may get to be a bit too technical, but part of our advantage is the ability to support very dynamic loads, which for a very short time period, it could be microseconds, it could be a millisecond, can rise to two or three times the steady-state level. You can imagine in an artificial intelligence task there being sudden demands for extra computing capacity, which are not necessarily, you know, continuous demands. But when you need it, you know, whether it's autonomous driving or some other task, you want to be able to, in effect, call on it. And among other things, you need a power system that can support it.
Since the Open Compute conference that you and Claudia attended, a number of you guys, it seems like there's an acceleration in the 48-volt architecture from what we're hearing. Can you just elaborate for the non-PhDs in the room how that plays into your IP and your strength, and how you're leveraging that with the 7 or 8 hyperscale data center guys that are seem to be adopting this?
Not PhDs, but studious followers of the industry. I think actually it's the one Open Compute conference that I didn't attend. I don't think Clyde attended either. The one a year and a half ago, I think February or March of last year, that not 2017, but 2016, that a move towards 48 volt got really underway. In fact, for the people in organization that attended both conferences, the 2016 and 2017 conference, there was something that was truly noticeable to them, the change in awareness and focus on 48 volt, because as of February 2016, before Google announced that they were joining and contributing a 48-volt server design, I think 48-volt was a relatively, you know, well-kept secret. It was regarded as something of, you know, a curiosity, out of the mainstream initiative. I think the industry at large was aware of the fact that Google in particular had adopted it several years earlier, but it had really escaped general following. And then, you know, Google made this announcement, and with it, it really encouraged the creation of an ecosystem of 48 volt building blocks and capabilities, you know, with various partners, and that, to your point, brought about the change in the environment. Now, as of this year, so a few months ago, there were suddenly a number of participants to the Open Compute with their own 48 volt solutions and in a variety of initiatives, so there was a palpable change of perception regarding 48 volt. I think since then, that's built, to your point, additional momentum. I think it's becoming generally clear that given trends with ASICs that and given the limitations of the traditional solutions, and I mentioned the number of them, current delivery, dynamic capability, turbo mode capability, where with on short bursts you need to deliver a lot more, that there is a lot to be said for a 48-volt solution. Now, there are some competitive 48-volt solutions. So as we know, they're still relatively mature. And aside from being relatively mature, they, even though they're 48, they don't provide the benefits of our solution, meaning, you know, for instance, they don't have the current multiplication function as we have. From a packaging technology perspective, they tend to be relatively bulky, typically three times the size of our traditional solution on the motherboard, the one that is shown out there, never mind the power and package type of solution. So we welcome the arrival of some level of 48-volt competition. To your point, certainly playing a role, a key role with respect to more widespread industry acceptance of 48-volt solution. I think the best kind of competition is a competition that fosters general adoption without creating much of a real competing alternative, particularly in demanding applications. Okay, go ahead.
Can I ask you a strategic question about employee ownership of shares?
Sure.
Having been a shareholder since the latter 2003, 2004, yeah. I do watch insider trading,
yeah.
Director ownership. And now I see the stock option plan, which I think is great, the expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say something philosophically about your view of employee retention and alignment motivation with ownership? My experience, having been in a public company for most of my career as CEO, is the biggest piece of it. I had very positive experiences as I went deeper into the organization with the option strategies.
Yeah. And so did Vigor in its early days. You know, fortunately, for quite some time, you know, our performance financially and in terms of, you know, growth had been, you know, disappointing. And that didn't create an opportunity either for employees or shareholders to get rewarded for their patience or investment of either financial capital or human capital into the success of the organization. As we approach a new phase, we're obviously planning to not just reward the shareholders, but you know, the many people that have contributed substantially to the success of the company. So.
What is the price of the 48-volt converter against the competition?
I'm sorry, didn't
you said that there are other 48-volt converters,
yeah,
in the market. What is the difference in price between your or Micro's unit,
yeah,
the competition unit?
Yeah. So we have only some preliminary indications of that. I think the solutions are competitive from a cost perspective, in part because, you know, some of the players, you know, particularly the power supply companies enabled by ASICs, developed by semiconductor manufacturers, you know, are willing to, you know, compete with relatively low margins. Benchmarking the competitive solution, both in terms of performance and in unit cost, you know, particularly in view of you know, where our products and capabilities are going, I think we have the upper end, both performance-wise and cost-wise, and is a very significant competitive advantage. I'll get quantitative because otherwise this can come across as being sort of very superficial generic statement. I'll give you an example of let's say, a building block of which we made, you know, a million back in the days of early generation IBM. Power platforms, computing platforms, in those days, our solution, our building block for mass conversion stage, you know, was priced at low double digits in terms of cents per watt. And at that level, it didn't really afford much of a margin for us, given where we stood in terms of our packaging technology and the level of serial integration within the packages. We've recently quoted for very high volume applications similar functionalities in new chip packages. And without getting too specific, I'll say that, you know, we've made quotes about one-fourth of the cents per watt figure of 7 years ago. And at that level, a one-fourth of the older price per watt figure, I expect we'll be making 55-60% margins very comfortably in very high volume. So part of our advantage is performance, but part of the advantage is because of the inherent attributes of the technology, both the power processing technology, the serial integration that goes with that power processing technology, and the underlying packaging technology. Part of our advantage is a very low cost structure. And this has been particularly developed, it has been coming together in recent times with what we call chip or converter housed in package technology, which enables us to make converters of you know, a variety of different kinds in a common denominator panel with processes that can endow the components, the constituents of that panel with all of the terminals and in effect the metal work that is required to interconnect them to the customer motherboard or the ASIC package. So this is a very scalable methodology for making devices that are getting smaller and smaller. So to give you again a more concrete example, referencing back the bus converter that you know we've been selling to IBM, designed in many years ago. That device is about 1 inch in size, and processes about 300 watts. Again, at 300 watts is sold in the low teens in terms of cents per watt, with not much of a margin because it was made in a dedicated, it is made still in a dedicated cavity, one at a time. The device that I referenced as the subject of a recent quote, processing 750 watts, is in about one-third of that size, and it gets made 32 at a time out of a panel this big. And that same panel technology supports not just that device, but every other chip we make. Fundamentally, our panel methodology is analogous to, you know, an established methodology in the semiconductor industry to process, you know, silicon in wafers that have common denominator processing steps, form factors, as they're taken through fabs to support a variety of needs for different kinds of silicon chips. Our chip, as a converter housed in package technology, likewise leverages this common denominator panel. In the case of silicon, it's typically a circular structure. In our case, it's a rectangular structure. But you know, the underlying principles of scalability, economy, common denominator processes, reliance on all those attributes to achieve lower and lower cost structures is the same. It is a very unique and heavily patent protected technology that we developed. This is one of those main things that the company has spent $300 million plus developing over the last 10 years with upwards of 100 patents. And by the way, track record of being very hard-nosed with respect to intellectual property protection. So going back to your question, competition is good. The competition will be aggressive on pricing, but competition does not have visibility with respect to our capabilities. They're shooting at a target, not yet realizing that their target has moved very far ahead, and it's got, particularly when it comes to its cost structure, significant advantages. They're not just performance advantages, they're cost advantages.
Sorry.
No, go ahead. That's right.
Here. It's a pleasure to find you so loquacious. It's very helpful. It's appreciated. I'd like to shift the discussion from technical issues to market size issues.
Mm-hmm.
It is a significant challenge to get one's arms around the growth of data centers and its implications for all of the products that go into data centers. And a lot of the forecasts out there are clearly wrong. It would be helpful if you would describe your understanding over the next 3, 5, even 8 years of what you think growth in the data centers are. Help us understand some of the differentiation between hyper data centers, traditional data centers, an area that's emerging between the two, so that we can understand your enthusiasm for Vicor.
So first of all, my enthusiasm for Vicor is not predicated solely on our growing participation in the center space, because I think, as you may know, because of the attributes of our technology and the modular converter strategy that we've implemented, we get to, among other things, benefit for this common denominator approach to virtually every market in a growing electronics industry. Obviously, data centers are very stationary. It's a big investment for the companies that are competing in that space with cloud computing and other kinds of services. But at the other end of the spectrum, we're looking forward over time at mobile applications, not as in this sense, but as in automotive, where the electronic content is growing, not just because of the eventual general emergence and ultimate dominance of electric vehicles, but because of all the functions, including all of the artificial intelligence functions that need to be incorporated within smarter and smarter mobile devices. So, frankly, I don't spend a lot of time trying to analyze the specific details of, growth in particular, say, the center market. I know it's very substantial for obvious reasons, given how, computing and access to computing capability, in particular, again, through cloud computing and a variety of services that are offered and are going to be offered, that makes it self-evident that it's going to be a significant growth market. But because of the fact that our strategy is not uniquely predicated or pinned to any particular end market, we're a very diversified strategy. I rest comfortably on the general proposition that with the same type of solutions and building blocks, we can address different markets. Obviously, when it comes to marketing, selling, and supporting from an application perspective, different customers in different markets, that part of the challenge is not always scalable, but it's made a lot easier by the fact that the building blocks themselves, are generally, quite scalable.
And rephrase the question to one that has to do with your capacity to meet growth over the next 3 to 5 years, which also brings up an issue which is the company has had in the past, which is licensing and leveraging your ability to respond to a multifaceted market whose segment growth you may not particularly focus on, but from the standpoint of capacity and planning, you certainly have to.
Yeah, so let me take one step at a time. Within our federal seed facility, we see the opportunity to get to around $600 million worth of yearly revenues. We're also getting very serious about looking at space not too far away. To some degree, create a level of redundancy with respect to the federal seed facility, and to some degree create a location where ships can be made soup to nuts in a continuous process that doesn't require trips to satellite facilities as is currently the case. So we have plans for getting more capacity out of existing facilities. We have plans, early plans, to expand those facilities in our neck of the woods, possibly across the border from Mass, but maybe within Mass, we'll have to wait and see. I think the opportunity of licensing in a vertical market is always a consideration. The investment in the manufacturing infrastructure, manufacturing technology to enable, to equip a licensee to make chips is pretty substantial. So by definition, this would not be, this would have to be a very serious commitment that aside from involving a substantial reward for us, commensurate to the level of investment we made in developing this technology, would have to account for the reality that to get into manufacturing these kinds of products, that's not a walk in the park. Now, to set things in proper perspective, we're not talking about the kinds of investments that companies in the semiconductor space have to make nowadays to have state-of-the-art manufacturing facilities. It's literally orders of magnitude less, but still, this is not something that one can get in for a few million dollars worth of investment. It's an order of magnitude rather than that. So I think with the right opportunity in the right end market and enough motivation and commitment, there is that possibility. But remarkably, and this question has come up in the past, customers that have a need for state-of-the-art solutions in order to raise their competitive standing vis-a-vis their competitors have been very flexible in terms of committing to a viral solution that is effectively single source. This has not been the single source nature of these kinds of engagements has not been that much of a stumbling block. And by the way, it would be, to the extent it is in some cases, lessened by the existence of this alternate manufacturing facility, because remarkably, and I recently had a discussion with a Texas company, which is particularly known, a Texas-based company, for its commodity capabilities in the computing space. They are definitely concerned about single source manufacturing, as in all the products coming out of one manufacturing facility, to the point that that could be a stumbling block. Not as concerned about, in effect, having one company be their sole supplier.
Thank you.
Patricio, a couple of years ago, go back and say 10, 15, I think you described the overall power conversion market as being about 25 to 30 billion a year, and that your products would address perhaps 10% of that available market. With all the growth of some of these new technologies, the artificial intelligence, going into the electric cars and so on and so forth, what do you see the size of the marketplace, say, in another 5 years, and with the new products you've developed, what percentage of that market will your products address? Could you compete in?
I think it's large enough that it doesn't really present a constraint in our growth in the foreseeable future. And for that reason, frankly, is in answering the earlier question about the size of the data center space, I don't spend a lot of time worrying about what is the size of the addressable market. Suffice it to say that it's far, far larger than would provide reasonable constraints to our growth for as far as the eye can see. And to your point, what is the current trends in the industry, and these are trends that are accelerating. One of our customers, the one I was increasingly referencing earlier, which was first to deploy MCMs within an ASIC package, likes to talk in terms of an approaching point of singularity, in the sense of the rate of change accelerating, exponentially, as new capabilities, new systems, and demand, human demand for, in effect, a variety of solutions, possibly involving artificial intelligence, for not just cars driving themselves, but addressing health issues, or a variety of other opportunities. But this singularity is approaching. A singularity, by definition, is something that, as I speak, will be so large that worrying about the size of the market is really not worthwhile, because that's not where the constraint comes from. The real constraint it comes from adoption and what stands in the way of getting some solutions that are clearly better and more efficient, more dense, more faster responding, more flexible.
I'm looking so much at the constraints, but just the potential. And would I be right to simply say that you see the overall marketplace significantly growing, and that your products address a bigger percentage of that marketplace than they had in the past?
There's no question that the marketplace is growing, and there's no question that our technology is unique in being able to much more efficiently address those needs. There's also no question that our competitive position vis-a-vis any alternative has grown. So if I compare where we stood, let's say, 3 years ago, both in terms of performance and cost, versus the competition at that point in time, and where we stand today on performance and cost, we are accelerating faster and faster with respect to performance levels while getting our cost structure, you know, way down. And nowadays, there are solutions where we can quote a building block at 2.5 cents per watt with 55-60% margin. I mean, I could not have envisioned that as recently as a few years ago. So the market is increasing. If some people talking about an approach to singularity are correct, it will be, at least for a while, increasing somewhat exponentially. So feeding on itself as it goes. Our competitive standing is improving, and improving at a significant rate. I'm not talking about margin rate improvements. Our capabilities are getting much more adept year after year, and I don't see an end in sight to that trend, because fundamentally we have a methodology, but in terms of the engine, the packaging technologies, that is still relatively young and full of opportunity as compared to, you know, alternatives that are somewhat stale and constrained in terms of what they can ultimately do, because they've been worked on for a long time and there's not much of an opportunity left. So the challenge that we face is to, in effect, convert the potential into reality, top line, bottom line, you know, addressing demanding customer needs, that's where the real constraint with respect to growth is going to come. It's not going to be from the size of the center space or the size of the electronics industry as a whole.
Within that, do you need to change the structure of SG&A or R&D to sort of accelerate that, or do we keep sort of same the pattern of just very modest growth R&D from this high level? And but do you also need, is there something you need to do in the SG&A structure, not the DNA, but the S structure, or the support structure?
So I think the company is at a mature state with all the implications of that, many of which are positive, you know, some of which are potentially negative. So our R&D process, I would say, is very efficient. I think people would be stunned in knowing how many different initiatives, you know, we're able to entertain at the same time, expanding the capabilities of a product line and addressing unique customer needs. Having been at it for quite some time, the organization has developed a level of capability that is quite remarkable, you know, like a gymnast exercising all the time, it has been able to stretch and reach for things that would have been, you know, scary. In particular, I'll go back to the example of our first installation with Power and Package, which just took place over the last few months. I was repeating over and over again to our customer and to our people that making this happen would be nothing short of a miracle. But the miracle, remarkably came to pass because we have an organization that is quite capable. And it's not just R&D, also operations. We have very mature capability in operations. So there are obviously other facets of the company that could potentially represent areas of concern. And I think that maturity can bring with it some negative traits that we get to obviously be mindful of. I think the organization is very energized, very positive. Generally capable. Objectively, we are engaging in the front end of the business with those companies that are at the forefront in their field, and I see them more and more excited about adopting our products, our solutions, and making the most out of them. So, without question, we cannot take anything for granted. And on every facet of the enterprise, we get to constantly ask ourselves, what more or what different thing should we be doing? Obviously, the revenues of the company have not really gone anywhere for a long time. It'll be very interesting to see what happens over the next couple of years. We have some very ambitious goals for the next couple of years, but there's nothing like doing it, and thus far it hasn't yet, happened. So doing it is what it's all about. Go ahead.
Good morning. Your comments so far have mostly focused on power for electronic systems, but the company also has some efforts in lighting and driving large LED systems is an example that you highlight in company information. But I'm kind of interested in architectural lighting and the move to distributed low voltage power systems. And that's not something that you seem to be in yet, but does that represent another opportunity? Are your products specifically well suited to that industry and to those applications?
Were you at the Montreal Grand Prix this weekend overhearing what Claudia and I were talking about?
No, sir.
Actually, Claudia and I were just talking about this weekend, visiting with one of our distributors who holds an event in the contest of the Montreal Grand Prix, and I was traveling from the hotel to the event with the person in charge of their LED lighting business, which is going to cross $1 billion over the next couple of years. And to your point, so-called distributed distributed power architecture for lighting is coming. Within the last couple of years, it has gained some level of momentum. It's not quite real yet. The opportunity is very clear. With traditional incandescent lighting being replaced by much more efficient and potentially long-lived LED lighting, it no longer makes sense to distribute power to light bulbs through an AC line, which requires you know, a licensed technician because of potential safety issues. LEDs operate from volts as opposed to, you know, 100 or 200 volts, depending on which country you're in. They are powered from DC voltages and DC currents. And what distributed lighting is all about is building in an infrastructure within a floor of a building or a whole building where instead of you know, wiring AC to traditional light bulbs that recently have been replaced by LED equivalents, but that still misses a big deal of the opportunity, where instead you distribute DC at a safe level, 48 volts, here we go again, and that 48 volt source can be you know, wired with you know, a fine cable. There's no safety issues. Anybody and their grandmother can do it. There is a good way of doing this, and once again, there's a lot of opportunity that remarkably line up with our technology. The lighting business when it comes to LED is what I'm fond of calling the Wild West. It's an emerging industry where the rules are still being written, you know, many players have focused on this emerging market, not necessarily with much of a clue with respect to where it ultimately will be, but there's no question in my mind it's going to be supported by a distributed power architecture with 48-volt bus, you know, a centralized, you know, power converter centralized within, you know, a floor, not including any limited light components. And we have unique technology, again, that is perfectly lined up with that, and which remarkably is the same technology that goes into powering a 3-megawatt supercomputer with power and package, a three-phase front end, the size of an iPad, capable of processing 10 kilowatts. They can support a lot of LEDs throughout a whole building. Now, this opportunity to be realized obviously requires the right, you know, approach. Retrofitting, you know, bulbs with LEDs isn't the long-term answer. There is short-term opportunities. You know, existing buildings, you know, the cost of redoing all the wiring wouldn't make sense. But starting with new buildings, particularly, you know, office space or industrial space, where there's an opportunity with the greenfield to do it right, you have the right opportunity. We're not yet organized to go after that opportunity. To your point, we actually do sell quite a bit into the LED market, but it is more of a reactive engagement than a proactive engagement, meaning, you know, we have customers that seeing the small size of a product and some of its attributes come to us for solutions. But the real opportunity would arise from a concerted effort to in effect, prepare the world with all to engage and promote a distributed power architecture solution with all of its ingredients. And remarkably, this is a case where we don't have to develop. You know, ID folks don't have to go back and, you know, spend 2 years. We have the building blocks because of other initiatives. But this is an area where, in fact, after coming back from Montreal early this week, I had a chat with some of our sales folks, and they're putting together an analysis of what it would take to get serious about the lighting business. You know, again, our challenge is that we have so many opportunities. We come under the building blocks. and we have to pick and choose which ones we can reasonably go after.
Is there any concern out there about a single source, and particularly a single physical facility?
Yes and no. So it varies from customer to customer. So, for instance, our largest customer, they are somewhat concerned about some of our suppliers. So actually, this past week, you know, some of our people visited in Asia with two key people, a major customer, seeing to it that we have assured source of supply for some of our PCBs coming from a vendor other than the one we've been primarily using, because they're concerned about bottlenecks, you know, from some of our suppliers. You know, maybe they're being polite, they haven't voiced a very serious concern with respect to you know, us and our manufacturing facility. They must be crossing their mind, or the minds of some of their people at times, and that's another reason why we do want to, in the next year, move on, you know, a second major manufacturing facility. As suggested earlier, I think the prime concern is dependency on a single manufacturing site, more so than a single company as the supplier of the product. Because the issues relating to that, be they cost issues or other kinds of issues, they can be addressed in supplier agreements, contracts that in effect provide the customer with the RFC protections. So, and we're doing more and more of that kind of thing with more and more customers. So, you know, we engage the, you know, more legal support, internal in particular, to deal with unique requirements from different customers in their supply relationship with us. I'll get back to you in a moment. Please go ahead.
You just mentioned the LED existing facilities versus a new facility. Can you help me understand that in data center space, where you have a customer that's expanding their data centers, for us looking at this expansion, both the data center expansion and for the revenues, how the revenues of Vicor would follow with lead lags, etc. And then also on a new customer, but with existing data, and how you go into an existing data center, what you can do. 48
and whatnot, and then
when they're
putting up new data centers, and how you can get those examples. So, once we are a partner of a customer that, let's say, made the decision to go 48 volt for the data center, you know, power systems, the business opportunity and how it relates to new data centers being built is very straightforward. The center gets built, it gets equipped with servers, and you know, the servers need power, and there's a whole infrastructure of suppliers, including us, that support that scale up. When it comes to new customers that haven't yet made the transition to 48 volt solution, that's a very different process. One that typically involves, unfortunately, years of gestation. This decision is not an easy decision, because it's an infrastructure decision which has got very long-term, you know, ramifications. So it's not taken lightly by anybody. So when it comes to driving our business forward, we are enjoying with existing customers, you know, spreading our wings to power more and more sockets within a customer board. The example that is given out there is a prime example of spreading our wings, because in this particular system we power, you know, just about every processor, every memory rail, which has not been typically the case in the past. So that evolution is and getting designed into more programs and capturing a bigger share of the footprint within any one board. That's part of it. I think the more difficult challenge is, you know, convincing you know, some of the giants, let's say in the data center space, and we all know, you know, who they are, you know, to make a transition. And I got word that some of them may be concerned about the single source situation that Vicor would represent. But ultimately, with compelling technology and a reduced total cost of ownership, which is a very sensitive figure of merit aspect of this whole proposition, because these customers pay for the utility bills, so they get to reduce their cost structure significantly with more efficient power solutions. With those kinds of TCO arguments, compelling arguments, and even more significant than total cost of ownership, you know, the when we get back to, let's say, artificial intelligence solutions, you know, if in order to achieve a certain level of capability, it takes, you know, Vicor technology to do it, and your competitor in that space has got it, that makes the decision a lot more easier to come about, right? So I think we're going to have opportunities over time to accelerate the rate of progress. I think going back to, you know, the challenge in the near term is to, you know, finally demonstrate that we can break out of the $250 million revenue level. And I think once we get, you know, past 300, 350, it's going to become easier to take the next step. In part because when we go back to the issue of adoption, some of the customers viewing Vicor as a relatively small company are concerned about that. And seeing Vicor succeed will provide more motivation or address some of the concerns they would otherwise have with respect to committing to us.
Could you just mention some recent successes for you with the GPU space?
I'm sorry, your
successes for Vicor in the GPU space.
Yeah, so we are we're making inroads there. I think it's going to take a little while to turn that into you know, big. Big volumes, but you know, we do expect to see tens of millions of dollars worth of revenues from GPU sales in years to come. Go ahead.
I heard talked about a lot of success, and let's say the success really happens and 2-3-fold is going to be really explode. Two things: I haven't heard a lot about human capital.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, do you need unique skills in the manufacturing area? So you're going to expand to be able to staff you that. And the second, right, equally or more importantly, is your staff. Is your staff ready to explode to that next level? Do you have the capabilities there?
Okay, well, let's start with the manufacturing scalability. The company's maturity and past experiences have led it to make the right choices with respect to a chip manufacturing technology. You know, we're relying, even though we have unique processes, we made a concerted effort to support them with equipment that can be procured typically within 3 or 4 months. So there is a few pieces of equipment which, on their first purchase, have a longer gestation period, 7 or 8 months. But after having purchased the first one, so this particular piece of equipment that's getting installed in about a month and a half, was ordered quite some time ago, but follow-on deployments of the same kind of equipment will take less time. So we've had, our operations team has had quite a bit of focus on, in effect, how to set things up to copy and paste to another building, to another facility, to potentially a different country, without having to reinvent the manufacturing line or its processes. So we believe we have very high degree of scalability. And again, we have a very mature operations team that has over and over demonstrated its ability to rise to the challenge and get things done. Again, I'll cite the example of going from zero MCMs to 36,000 in the space of a couple of months. That's quite a feat, reflective of, you know, a capability that, among other things, has got, you know, scalability behind it. Human capital in general, you know, obviously the company is going to have to grow all around, and in other areas, including the front end of the business, and I guess in all the facets of the human capital of the company, we're going to have to grow. We think that we have the people in place to get to revenue levels that are substantially higher than where we are, and we're looking forward to that because we're mindful of the bottom line. We made a huge investment, and we afforded this investment, a $300 million plus investment in the underlying capability. We are keen on seeing that investment begin to pay off. It's going to take the higher revenues, but we think we can drop a significant fraction of that incremental revenue to the bottom line as the revenues start to come in. Once that has happened, we're obviously going to be willing to reinvest in the business. But in the very short term, I think we're going to be well enough equipped with the infrastructure we have, whether it's R&D, operational overhead, sales and marketing. And over time, the company will grow in every respect once we can afford to invest more in the human capital.
Can I?
Sure.
What you have now, if I listened to you earlier, you said you can get up to $600 million mm-hmm. with the staff you have right now.
Well, there was a reference to the facility. We can, out of our primary manufacturing facility, which is at the border of New Hampshire on the Massachusetts side, we believe we can get out of that 250,000 square feet facility, 250,000 square feet facility, around $600 million worth of yearly revenues.
I just think with everything exploding, a lot of companies wanting probably the same type of people you have, and you're going to put something in New Hampshire, are there going to be people there that's going to be able to, you're going to be able to attract them? Are you going to be unique enough to attract them?
Yeah, and obviously that's part of the reason why we are going to step things up in terms of incentives, stock options. But remarkably, we've had a very good track record of employee retention. I think our employees generally understand what the company is up to and the level of commitment we made, and that we are quite real with respect to it. So we are attracting and retaining good people. I mean, I just within the last several years, for instance, on the operational front, I can think of the back of my head of, you know, some remarkable additions that have enabled us to develop, for instance, some of the chip packaging technology. We could not have done this kind of thing if we followed the trends in the industry back in past time frames when it was very popular for manufacturing companies to go, you know, first to the Caribbeans and then to Mexico and then to China and then from China to some other place. You know, as a Massachusetts-based company with a tight-knit organization, R&D, electrical engineering, mechanical, you know, manufacturing processes, operational infrastructure, we have we fostered you know, the right kind of environment for human capital, human ingenuity to develop those skills and capabilities that set us apart from the competition. That level of intelligence is abundantly available in Massachusetts, in parts of New Hampshire, nearby. So I'm not afraid we're going to run out of human skills in every facet of the company, particularly the operational facet. I think a gentleman in the back had the...
You stated in the past, and it's well understood, the caveats associated with plans to spin off PyCorp.
And be a chip.
Sorry.
Both. Yeah.
Those caveats and conditions are I think, appreciated by the Street. Thanks for the conference calls. I'm interested in what change of thinking there may have been, how it's evolved, and what your sense is of the rough range timing of when that might take place under expected conditions.
Yeah, so the conditions are coming together. The growth is going to come from products that have been you know, developed by VHIP and PIGA. I think, as we communicated earlier, these efforts, which have been orchestrated independently of one another, I'm referring to the VHIP and PIGA effort, for good reason, have, you know, more recently been coordinated more intimately because of overlapping opportunities. It used to be the converter modules on the one end and the ASICs that go into them. Well, some of the ASICs going into them have turned into, you know, power packages that sometimes we don't make. We procure from Asian manufacturing partners. Those are some of the products that we're able to outsource. But some of these products compete literally with other products we make in Andover with somewhat different attributes. So these overlapping initiatives have been restructured to be better aligned in terms of a synergy between point of load solutions and front-end solutions. That's a better demarcation line that enables us to better deal with the market opportunity with a divide-and-conquer strategy that has the right focus and the right synergy. Now, we're going to have significant growth in the point-of-load solutions, which, again, have been spearheaded by VHIP and PIGO. We're also going to have very significant growth for front-end solutions, which have been primarily the focus of VHIP. The front-end solutions can best be thought as a VIGO power system solution at large, and whereas the point-of-load solutions are in a different category, where, again, PIGOR and VHIP have been on the forefront. With growth coming about in both, I think the time is approaching where there ought to be, you know, a liquidity opportunity for the human capital investment that has been made. So we're very committed to that, and look forward to a critical mass of revenues that would warrant taking that step, which we think is coming soon, in the next year, couple of years at the most.
Thank you. Have you considered restricted stock as a recruitment and a retention and a motivation for key employees?
We have. We most recently talked about that months ago. You know, my take with respect to it is that we obviously get to take care of incentivizing key employees, employees at large. I think it's important, though, not to be too creative with respect to providing incentive in a variety of different ways with, you know, potential overlap. So I think we have a good structure in place. We've had it in place for quite some time. The only problem with it is that the revenue growth that brings about the liquidity opportunity hasn't yet materialized. But I think at this point in time, what's most important is to create a liquidity opportunity for those instruments that were put in place, in some instances, more than 10 years ago. So we've had to issue new options to replace options that were granted over 10 years ago and expired. I think substituting or complementing with a different kind of instrument might create confusion or potential for double dipping or overlap. So I think it's important to just make sure that the instruments and the incentives that we put in place, you know, pan out before getting too creative. As discussed at the beginning, we're going to have stock purchase plan for employees at large. That's a different kind of thing. It's very commonplace. You know, there isn't a corresponding concern. But I think with the plan that has been approved today, we should be all set to have you know, plenty of financial incentive for the next few years.
Okay. Do you have good patents to avoid that people try to copy some of the characteristics of the 48 volt solution? Since in this country anybody can go to court, as you will know, and claim that they did it before, and you are an interloper or something of that sort.
Yeah. So we have very good patents, and we have many of them. And these are not frivolous claims. They are generally very, very good, sound claims, and we have lots of them. So if you were to, let's say, look at one of these products, let's say chip for deployment as a modular current multiplier, on an ASIC package, I think that device directly and indirectly, and that solution is covered by, you know, tens of different patterns. The cover, the power conversion engine, the control system, the packaging technology, in some cases some of the components that are used, the magnetics, you know, the way the substrate is manufactured, and the list goes on. So any competitor, and I've spoken to some, that have invested in effect dissecting our products, and I've spoken to some, I think rapidly reached the conclusion, having done investigations with respect to a file portfolio, that to copy a products, they would have to infringe not, you know, one patent, but a very large number of them. So fundamentally, the analogy that I'm fond of is not one of, let's say, I mean, to jump through a mine that you know where it is placed. It's walking across a large field full of mines, and people value their limbs. So so I think I know I spoke to one, and you know, he had drawn the conclusion that this was not something you would want to embark in. There is another facet to this. We have a reputation for being very hard-nosed about this. You know, we've been involved in intellectual property litigation over and over again. You know, and unfortunately, recently, meaning over the last 5 years, we've been, for the first time, on the defense side. But even in that experience, it became clear to both the company that sued us and all of the competitors in the industry who had gotten taken by this company, and they forked over $150 million to this company, that we have a bit of experience in intellectual property, understand the pitfalls, the issues. So I think any logical competitor would know that, one, there's a big handicap, and it's against the company that is not going to just sit idle or make it easy for them to steal our technology. That would not be the case. So I think the best evidence is the fact that, as far as we know, nobody has even tried. Now, that's not to say that that will never happen. It could. You know, people do stupid things. If and when that happens, so we're going to be very forceful about it.
We have time for one more question.
Okay.
Patricio, the switch from 12 volt to 48, especially in the data center in particular, it seems to me like it's just starting. There's a lot of 12 volt solutions still out there, it appears. Are we in the first inning? Are we in the sixth inning? I know we're not in the eighth or ninth inning, but where are we in that switch?
You're talking to somebody who grew up with soccer and never understood baseball. What I know, it's a very slow game. And not a very exciting one, at least from my perspective. I think we're in the first inning. If you measure it by the actual adoption, I think that you're going to have 48 volt systems in data centers. You're going to have them in buildings to provide lighting, as discussed earlier. I think you're going to have it in automobiles. You know, there was movement afoot many years ago to convert the 12-volt battery system to 48. I think BMW, there was some half-hearted initiative without much follow-through. But then again, I remember when we were involved with GM I forgot the name, but it was the EV1, I remember the name, which was an electric vehicle that, you know, GM upper management really didn't believe in, but, you know, they had to, in effect, make it look like they were serious about the future. So electric vehicles, when first considered, didn't come to reality, but I think we now all realize that it's not going to be long before Claudio Maserati is going to be a rare car on the road. There won't be the roar, but there's going to be all the efficiency and the benefits that come with electric car. I think likewise, 48 volt is going to become pervasive. It will take time. It is a baseball game. It's going to go until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I'm being carefully watched here. So with that, if there's nothing else, thank you all for coming today.